George Galloway has been egged during celebrations in Bradford following his by-election win last night. The Respect MP was targeted by a protester who described him as a joke. He won the Bradford West seat with a majority of over 10,000, and Mr. Galloway's told us where it ranks in his career.
This victory last night was the best moment, but I hope it's not my last good moment. And I made a lot of people happy.
Tomorrow's Premier League game between Aston Villa and Chelsea will go ahead at the insistence of Stylian Petrov. The club captain has been diagnosed with acute leukaemia after suffering from a fever following Saturday's defeat at Arsenal. The family of Fabrice Muamba have posted the Bolton player's first tweet since he suffered a cardiac arrest at Tottenham almost 2 weeks ago. It includes a picture of him sitting up in bed and smiling. And Robbie Williams is going to be a dad. The 38-year-old singer announced the news on his blog that his wife was pregnant. He says they both cried when they saw the scans. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
You can listen to BCFM live on the internet and also download every show as a podcast at bcfm.org.uk.
Soul Train is back with 5 rooms.
Main Arena.
80s and 90s soul anthem. Swing, R&B and old school. Room 2. 70s soul, disco, funk and boogie. Room 3. The Reggae Train with Revival and Lovers Rock. On the Terrace, jazz funk and rare groove. And now, Room 5 with Soulful House. Now serving soul food, jerk chicken and rice and peas. Takes place on Easter Bank Holiday, Sunday, April 8th, from 9 p.m. till 4 a.m. at Motion Club. Ticket, £10 each from Bristol Ticket Shop or Genesis Records.
More on the door.
For more info and full DJ lineup, join our Facebook group or go to soultrain.co.uk. Celebrating 20 years of soul.
Train.
It's the award-winning Top Soul Night outside of London. Be sure to arrive early as this event will be sold out.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Bristol Community FM is a registered charity, which means we're not for profit, and we're now able to support local business by offering low-cost promotional announcements and adverts about your business or products. You could even sponsor a show, event or outside broadcast. So why not support the station that supports the communities of Bristol? And contact us today to find out more. BCFM 93.2 FM. Bristol is our community. BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and helping us review this week's news are Labour MP Kerry McCarthy and Lib Dem MP Stephen Williams. After the 6 o'clock news, corruption in local government? Well, that's the question. After South Gloucestershire Council vote to scrap the cabinet system, we asked, does our political system sometimes shield wrongdoing? Esmond Jenkins is here from Cotswold Council to tell us why he believes public land may have been given to friends of people in the council. And we question rules for council officers who, of course, never have to face election. Are they too safe in their jobs? Plus, the murky world of the Freemasons. We hear some secret details of Masonic initiations, and I'm joined by a community activist and an engineer who both believe Masonic networks are being used by criminals to keep some communities down. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 10 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 11 Celsius, cloudy on Saturday, with some rain. Sunny, though, on Sunday. Next week, highs of 13 Celsius, fairly sunny week. Not quite as sunny, though, as last week. That would be difficult, wouldn't it? Next weekend, the 7th and 8th of April, highs of 11 Celsius, cloudy, with a few showers. That's Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests, and joining us is Kerry McCarthy and Stephen Williams. First of all, you, Kerry, hi and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi.
Now, you're a Labour MP. Why Labour? Why one of the other parties?
Well, tricky. Well, it's not tricky in terms of, I think actually if you look at the underlying ethos of the other two main parties, I would say it was very much an individualist political philosophy, whereas Labour is the party of the collective, of the community, of people working together, of socialism, if you like. And that, to me, always seemed the ethical underpinning that we ought to have in society.
Now, we've seen from the result today, haven't we, up in Bradford, that there's a lot of people that don't really think that, that actually they see the three main political parties, many people anyway, as sort of almost like three wings of the same party, which is the sort of the City of London, the Money Party, and they don't really see Labour as representing working people anymore.
Well, I don't think you can draw that conclusion just from one result, because there's been actually a significant number of by-elections. In the last Parliament, there were very few by-elections. I think we've had about half a dozen already. If you look at Feltham and Heston recently, Labour had a very good result there, and we've won all the other by-elections that have come up. So I think there are specific factors in Bradford and specific factors relating to George Galloway and his ability to mobilise communities. It's rather strange, actually. I think if you sort of pulled apart what the Respect political agenda was, the people who voted for him, it seems like the Tory and Lib Dem votes, for example, collapsed and they went straight over to Respect. Now, obviously, that's something that Labour has got to ask itself, why they didn't come over to Labour. But the idea that people who very comfortably voted for David Cameron's party in 2010 can vote for George Galloway, who purportedly is the other end of the political spectrum, that's rather strange.
But I mean, if you look at the figures, it actually was the Labour vote that collapsed and went over to George Galloway, not the other parties, because it was a very safe Labour seat up until George stood.
Well, the Labour vote went down, I think, from 40-something percent down to about 25%, but the Lib Dems lost their deposit, so it wasn't, and the Tories didn't do very well either. So it wasn't a good result for any of the main parties. George Galloway got over 50% of the vote. And I think the interesting thing is that people didn't really see that coming. Nobody did.
Well, quite a lot of people in Bradford did. They were betting on George Galloway. In fact, Ladbrokes lost more money in that than they've ever done before.
The odds at Ladbrokes were something like 33-1 as recently as Monday, and Galloway's only been in town a few weeks. So I think, yes, within the Asian community in particular, where he was mobilising, people had picked up on that momentum. But when I say nobody, I mean in the sort of the political journalists, the commentators, the people who are running the campaigns for the other parties, I don't think picked up on it at all.
So do you think Labour will learn lessons from Bradford?
Yeah, I think there are lessons to be learnt from it. I think there is, there's obviously in the case of Bradford, people who were, the people wanted to express a protest vote, people who were unhappy with the government didn't see Labour as the alternative, and people who voted Labour in the 2010 election. But it's very easy to be simplistic about it. I mean, some people are saying it's down to Iraq, but actually there's been the 2005 and 2010 elections in that seat since Iraq, and they returned a Labour MP. So there's other factors, and I think particularly, it's far too soon to sort of confidently express a view as to why Galloway, because the other thing is Galloway stood, it's not just the magic of George Galloway, he stood in 2010 in Poplar and Canning Town where he came third, he stood for the Scottish elections and failed to get elected. There are things to be looked at, but I think he, from what I'm hearing of reports on the ground, he particularly managed to mobilise young British Asians who are by and large sort of feel alienated and disaffected with mainstream politics, and that's something that we have to learn. But I think I welcome the fact that in some ways, I obviously didn't want him to win, and I have very little time for him as an individual, but perhaps now he's in Parliament, we'll get to put his policies under the spotlight a bit, because Respect is a very strange coalition of views, for example,
because he spent something like 15 years as a Labour MP, doesn't he? Why are you feel that you don't like the guy?
I think he's a deeply, deeply unpleasant man, just on a personal level, and I wouldn't say that about anybody else.
But at the end of the day, if he was facing David Cameron in the Commons, I mean, I can imagine George Galloway making mincemeat of Cameron.
Well, he's got the oratorical skills, and people always remember when he went off to the States and was questioned by the, I think it was the Senate committee, and, really they were just didn't know how to handle him. He has those sort of skills of the demagogue. That doesn't mean to say that I respect his views or the way he operates. And, for example, I've always sort of found it strange. I've sort of spoken to people from Respect in Bristol that someone who is very hardline on issues like, he's anti-abortion, anti-euthanasia, not got a brilliant record on gay rights. He described being gay as a lifestyle choice. How they could sit comfortably in a party with someone who's, he's a social conservative in some ways, quite similar to, maybe that's something that he's got in common with some people from the Muslim side of things. But the left wing people in Respect locally, I don't know why they've sort of never questioned where he's coming from on those.
Anyway,
issues.
Anyway, Stephen, Lib Dem MP, let me bring you in here. What's your thoughts about this Galloway victory, particularly? But before I ask you that, why the Lib Democrat Party for you? When you know, as you're going in towards politics, what was it about the Lib Dems that attracted you?
Well, I got involved in politics when I was a teenager, and largely the same reason as Kerry said. I think I agree with her analysis that I do believe in the rights of individuals, and while I do believe there is a role for the state in making sure that people don't fall into poverty and children are helped to keep up in school, and there should be strong public health interventions, broadly I think the state should step back and allow people or help people to succeed for themselves and to protect individual rights and to be against discrimination, whether it's race or sexuality, which is something that's important to me. So the sort of classic liberal viewpoint about
but you're sort of
the individual.
Do you think it's a halfway house though between this whole
collective
thing?
Because the liberal traditions existed in this country going right back to 1688. So I don't think it's a halfway house at all.
Well,
it's,
between the rights of the
British thinking,
between the rights of the individual and the rights of the sort of the society collective rights.
Well, all parties are coalitions, and there are liberals, and I'm sure Kerry would agree with this, that there are liberals within the Labour Party who would share my outlook. Indeed, believe it or not, there are some in the Conservative Party as well. There are some very strong state interventionist people in the Liberal Democrats who I sometimes feel would have more in common with people in Kerry's party. So all of our parties have individuals who hold particular views, and at different points in time, people might find themselves sometimes more comfortable with people of other persuasions. But if we can go back to Galloway, start off with a note of agreement with Kerry. I agree with her that Galloway is a pretty odious character, and I don't particularly welcome his return to the House of Commons. I feel sorry for Kerry and her colleagues because they're now going to have him sat with them on the opposition side. We had to put up with him for 5 years. We put up with him in the last 5 years.
But the people of Bradford West
didn't turn up very often.
But Stephen, the people of Bradford West have decided he's their man. Are they wrong or what?
Obviously, none of us around this table are particularly experts on the internal politics of what on earth goes on in Bradford, but on the face of it, it does seem to be an extraordinary smack in the face for Ed Miliband and the Labour Party. This has not been a good week for the coalition government in general. It's been a particularly bad week for the Conservative Party within the coalition. Given those dream circumstances for what seems to be a safe Labour seat, you'd have thought Ed Miliband today would have been driving around Bradford in the Labour campaign bus celebrating a great victory, instead of which it's been absolutely humiliated. And I think Labour Party ought to ask themselves some pretty searching questions why, given this background, that they couldn't even hold on to what, at least on paper, is a relatively safe Labour seat. But Galloway himself, I agree with Kerry, is not an attractive force in politics. He certainly got the gift of the gab, and I'm sure he'll be good political box office for the next 3 years with certain TV programmes and maybe in the House occasionally. But in terms of his views, as Kerry says, they are a curious ragbag. I think of social conservative. I think he's a Catholic, isn't he?
Yes.
Catholic. Scotsman, and there are quite a lot of those in the Labour Party who still aren't terribly good on gay rights and abortion and things.
But not Scottish.
But he's certainly breaking the mould at the moment, isn't he? And let's have a listen. I'll let you have a final comments in a second about George. Gorgeous George, as he's supposedly called by many people. And let's have a listen to a little excerpt from his victory speech up in Bradford West in the early hours, about 2:30 this morning.
This, the most sensational result in British by-election history, bar none, represents the Bradford Spring. This is an uprising amongst thousands of people, many of them young people never involved in the political process before, who have demonstrated in this mammoth majority, this mammoth vote, a total rejection of the three major parties on the British political scene. I care nothing for the Conservatives or the Liberal Democrats. I wish them political perdition. But I do care about the Labour Party, in which I served for 37 years, for 18 of which as a Labour Member of Parliament.
That was George Galloway, at least the beginning of his acceptance speech, which I imagine went on for a fair bit longer than that. But anyway, what he's saying essentially there, Stephen, is that essentially the three main political parties are out of touch. He's wishing your party and the Conservatives to perdition.
Well, he has his views. He's clearly an idiosyncratic figure in British politics. I suppose there has to be room for those views. But I think there are clear dividing lines in between the three parties, even the two of us that are in coalition. And most objective people would see that. George Galloway has carved out a niche for himself as being a one-man band party. I suspect there is no other party that has sufficient physical and mental space to accommodate a man of such a colossal ego.
Okay, Kerry, out of touch. I mean, one thing we have to say here is there's lots and lots of people out there, when we do our Vox Pops out on the street, who do say that the politicians of all parties are out of touch, and this does seem to be an endorsement of that.
Again, I think it's difficult to judge particularly what happened in Bradford, because it is an out of the ordinary result, and it doesn't bear much relationship to the other by-elections that have happened over the last year or so. But I think particularly with the budget, with the stories about cash for access in the last week, all the sort of sillier stuff, if you like, about pasties and so on, that feeling is growing amongst people. It was certainly there during the 2010 election, that people who were being squeezed and sort of felt that their cost of living was going up, they were worried about the economic situation, felt that there weren't really people fighting their corner. Now, I could sort of read you chapter and verse of Labour policies that I would say are supporting those people, and Stephen will no doubt sort of claim some of the things in the budget are backing them as well. But that becomes slightly irrelevant when people's perception is different. And I think even the expenses scandal didn't help, because people all think that we live in duck houses. Live in duck houses. I could probably fit in a duck house, actually. I'm not sure if everyone else could. But people think we have duck houses and moats and all live in chateaus, because a number of MPs did. So I think there is that gulf. And the only way you can really combat that is getting out and about and meeting people and speaking up for them and not being, afraid to. Yeah, well, it's about taking the fight. Perhaps we're not being seen as taking the fight to the government the way that we should.
Well, our view certainly on this programme about the MP's expenses has been, it's a bit of a storm in the teacup, really, in that the amount spent on investigating the MP's expenses scandal was far more than the actual amount of expenses that had been apparently misspent. And anyway, we need to fund our MPs. But maybe I could ask both of you, what the system is like now and how easy it is for you to claim your expenses, because a lot of people have been saying it's an absolute nightmare of a system.
It's funny, actually, because there have been lots of complaints about the new body that regulates it, and I don't think there were some sort of issues with the way they'd set up the computer system stuff.
So it's worked okay for you.
I think it's okay, but we are more restricted in what we can spend money on, and the main thing that I care about is being able to pay my staff properly, and we both have very busy offices, and we've just had a bit of an increase in the staff budget, and that's far more important to me than having an increase in my own salary.
And what's your experience of this expenses, the new regime, Stephen?
It didn't start off very well. I mean, particularly for new MPs. I mean, Kerry and I were obviously returning MPs and didn't have start-up expenses of the extraordinary thing. When I was elected in 2005, as the first Liberal in Bristol since 1935, we had to set up an office from scratch. I had to personally buy furniture from IKEA and then wait for the money to come back. But the new system, I know MPs, and I'm sure there would have been new Labour MPs as well, who were in debt personally for quite a long time while the new system was being set up. I think that was awful. It's now a lot better. I was on the parliamentary committee that reviewed how the independent independent parliamentary standards authority was operating, and we published a report with lots of recommendations. They are now implementing those recommendations. The increase in the staff budget that Kerry just referred to was one of those, and one of the most important things that we fought and argued for on a cross-party basis. And I think the system now works, and the important thing is that people have confidence that MPs are only being paid what they're supposed to be paid, they're only claiming the expenses that are due, and in fact the word expenses itself is hopefully going to disappear from the system as well, because of course none of these are actually personal expenses. When the newspapers say Kerry McCarthy, Stephen Williams claimed £250,000,
well, that is
actually
the
most of it yeah. is our staff salary.
Yeah.
You know, £120,000 of that goes into the pockets of staff. Another slug of it goes off to whoever we rent our constituency offices from, buying toner cartridges. I'm sure everyone who's listening to the program knows is not a cheap exercise, and we write lots of letters. And those, you know, that's where the money goes. It doesn't fund an extravagant lifestyle for either of us.
Okay, so let's have a look at this week's first story. Joanna Yates' police chief, that's our very own Colin Port, the chief constable of Avon and Somerset Police, denies off-the-record briefings to journalists. The chief constable of Avon and Somerset described as outrageous the Daily Mirror editors claim that the paper was privately told by police in the Joe Yates case that Christopher Jeffries was their man. Colin Port told the Leveson Inquiry on Tuesday his force did not give any off-the-record briefings. So before we discuss, let's have a listen now to a little clip from Radio Bristol, where they did they had Colin Port, Chief Constable at the Leveson Inquiry, on Tuesday this week.
Colin Port responded to accusations made by the Mirror's editor Richard Wallace. Mr. Wallace claimed that police had made it clear to journalists that Chris Jeffries was their man. Chief Constable Port said the claims were outrageous and abhorrent. He also denied that the police deliberately informed journalists about Mr. Jeffries' arrest.
We don't announce people who've been arrested. They're innocent, and we don't do that. There was an inadvertent leak, which I talked about in my statement, which was a mistake by some people. It was a genuine error. We sought to address that situation right away with the journalists concerned, but we certainly didn't give any off or on the record comment that it was Mr. Jeffries who'd been arrested. The only time we did was the inadvertent leak.
Well, what Colin Port actually said at the Leveson Inquiry was the following. He was asked, it is not uncommon for the police to give such an indication. This is a quote from the editor of the Daily Mirror. I believe our coverage of this news story should be viewed against that background. The content desk informed me that Mr. Jeffries was arrested on 30th of December, and the police were saying that they were confident that Mr. Jeffries was their man. Colin Port then responded, it's absolutely outrageous. The assertion, I have been, as pointed out by the chair, a police officer for a long time. I've never done that. It's not my job to pass opinion on these issues. We don't give off-the-record briefings, and to behave in a collusive manner is just abhorrent. Unfortunately, it didn't seem to be broadcast at all, the actual quote from Colin Port. So we had that quote there, which was a little bit after that. But ultimately, Stephen Williams, with you first, we know that the police do this on occasions, and also that there is, I mean, something that we know as journalists is that police sometimes will brief against the truth. I mean, you know, this is in order to wrongfoot the real criminal. In important cases like this, they will sometimes give information out to the media, the idea being to get the criminal, whoever it is that they believe may be really responsible, to drop their guard to a certain extent. And I wonder what you think about the truth of what Colin Port's saying here, and also the ethics of the police sometimes telling half-truths to the press in order to catch the criminal.
Well, I think what you just outlined, that the police may have good reason for saying things to journalists which they believe will then help them catch the actual criminal that they're really after. I personally don't have a problem with it. I'm sure most listeners wouldn't have a problem with it either. What I think everyone should have a problem with, and anyone who thinks back to December 2010 onwards when this dreadful murder took place, is the pretty appalling treatment of Chris Jeffries, who is a suspect in the case, by most of the tabloid press, other than our own Brussels Evening Post, who I thought handled that major news story in the city very well, very objectively. But the national tabloids printed the most outrageous stuff about Chris Jeffries, who, in the interest of transparency, I should say, I've known for nearly 20 years, in Clifton, as a Clifton he's a Clifton resident who has helped me in previous elections and all that, you know, was reported at the time as well. And I was astonished when he was arrested, because I thought this man who I know couldn't possibly have done what it is suggested. But I guess we all like to think that no one who is arrested, who we know is capable of such a crime. And I'm glad, obviously, he turned out to be completely innocent. But he would not have been able to have had a fair trial if the police had pressed charges against him, because of how the Sun, the Daily Mirror, and other newspapers had, you know, called him at the mild end a nutty professor, and at the not so mild end, you know, referred to him as, you know, basically a Nazi paedophile, to paraphrase some of the stories that were written about him, which was British tabloid reporting at its very, very worst. And of course, these newspapers have now had to pay substantial damages.
Do you believe Colin Port
have been fined?
Do you believe Colin Port when he tells Leveson that he is certain that there were no off-the-record briefings at all by anyone in Avon and Somerset Police?
Well, from the transcript I've read, he said he believes the briefing came from elsewhere. Obviously, we'll have to. He was giving that evidence under oath at the Leveson inquiry.
But
he's the chief
else?
Constable. It would be a very serious matter if he wasn't telling the truth.
Where else?
Well, I don't know. I think an awful lot of what was in the newspapers, frankly, was just made up stuff. I'm sure, Tony, you won't deny that journalists do. A lot of the stuff that appears in tabloids isn't necessarily the truth.
Kerry, what's your view on this? And also on that issue I was saying about the ethics of whether it is okay for the police to brief against the truth in order to wrong foot and catch a criminal.
Well, I always remember the case of... I can't remember the names of the individuals involved, but there was a case where a student killed his girlfriend and hid her body under the floorboards, and I remember the police sort of putting him up at press conferences, pleading for her killer to be found. And I think there was a sort of degree of collusion about that, where they led him to... They always suspected it was him right from the start, but sort of led him on. So I think that's one thing. But I do think, you know, as the whole Leveson inquiry is exposing, there's a big difference between using journalists to help catch a criminal and police officers profiting from a relationship with journalists, you know, feeding them inside information on stories, tipping them off about things, you know, and that seems fairly obviously to have been going on. And I always thought that when the whole Murdoch and hacking thing blew up about was the beginning of the summer recess, really, so nearly a year ago, the police element of it, the role of the police and possible police corruption, didn't seem to get the attention that it deserved, and I think it should, because obviously we've got to make sure that police aren't taking bribes or backhanders from anybody.
Well, we now know that has been taking place,
exactly,
at the Metropolitan,
yeah,
Police. So do you believe Colin Port in this instance, that he is sure that it wasn't one of his officers that was speaking to the Daily Mirror or anybody else?
Well, it'd be interesting to know, you know, what inquiries he's carried out to see whether it was or not, because he wouldn't necessarily know if somebody is sort of going, you know, is going behind people's backs and leaking information. But, you know, I'm perfectly happy to believe that Colin wouldn't have briefed anybody if, you know, and that the evidence he's given is correct to the best of his knowledge. But it was fairly obvious that there was a very steady stream of information being given to the press. There was a real media frenzy around the Joanna Yates case and around Mr. Jeffries being arrested. And I think it's fairly obvious that information must have been coming from somewhere. And if it was a tightly run police investigation, there shouldn't have been many people other than the police that knew any of that information.
On a more human level, Stephen, as you know, Chris, how has this whole business affected him?
Well, he's had to change his appearance because he had quite a distinctive appearance before, which is one of the reasons why the press picked on him. I think he was unable to live in his home for a while, but I think his life now has returned more or less to normal, and I'm glad that's the case. And, you know, he's now putting himself back in the public eye and making, you know, comments about government policy on legal aid. So I very much welcome the fact that he's now obviously feeling able to be himself again. But he went through an absolutely awful experience. I think the Leveson inquiry in general is going to be a seminal moment in British public life when Lord Justice Leveson pronounces. I think there'll be journalists, police officers, and probably politicians who are going to be grossly embarrassed and perhaps disgraced as a result of it.
But it doesn't really substitute for a proper old-fashioned public inquiry, which has the power to put people behind bars if they're found to be telling lies. It seems to be more of a sort of almost a media exercise in front of the cameras rather than a proper inquiry.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by proper inquiry, but this is a judge-led inquiry. People have been summoned to give evidence, and I'm sure quite a lot of the journalists and editors. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed Paul Dacre, the editor of the Daily Mail, being questioned by the barrister and by the judge. He obviously hated every second of it. I enjoyed every second of it, and he wouldn't have been there if it wasn't a proper inquiry. And I'm sure the Daily Mail, the Sun, the Mirror, maybe other newspapers are all going to have questions to answer when the report comes out.
Well, he's doing the Marina Morris job this week. Martin Summers has got a report now on the budget, and this is 10 days ago or so now. Martin, over to you.
Shall I do Marina's accent?
Hello. No.
Hello. Here I am. The main comments I would make about the budget was that everybody widely saw it as a fiscally neutral budget. In other words, there were no changes in the projected deficit. There was no increases which weren't balanced by increases in taxes, for example, or decreases in taxes that weren't balanced by some other expenditure. And I think, but because the Labour front bench have decided that some cuts are necessary, there was basically no big debate about the macroeconomic stance of the government. So it was all about who bore the pain, and obviously the headline on that was the 50p tax rate being down to 45p, and of course this was justified with reference to the Laffer curve. I understand that the budget statement even had a Laffer curve in it. Arthur Laffer was the economist who came up with this bright idea in the 1980s, and the Laffer curve is a normal distribution curve drawn on a graph which shows that any rate over 50p in tax will lead to a decrease in tax take. That's what the underlying theory behind it is. Of course, there's no empirical evidence for that whatsoever. It's just a normal distribution curve drawn on a graph. And as I used to say to my students in the 1980s, this is the laughable Laffer curve, not based on any kind of empirical analysis whatsoever. But of course, the wealthy classes love the idea that the less tax they pay, if there's too much tax on them, then the government loses out. No evidence for that. Top rate of tax in Britain in the 1950s was 92%. 95%, 96%, and 92% in the United States of America, and they carried on taking money right up to that high level. So what's extraordinary to me is that George Osborne's coming out with this really, really discredited economic theory to justify what he's doing on that level. But anyway, as I say, there was no real macroeconomic substance to the budget. That's previous budgets where you've had the macroeconomic stance of the government made clear. But if we look at what's happening in the macroeconomy, the deficit... The government's borrowing for January was supposed to come in, the markets expected to come in at 8 billion. It came in at nearly 16 billion. Now, this may just be a one-off. We can't presume that that's going to be it's 1 month's figures. But if it is the case that the deficit of the amount the government needs to borrow is going to come in at double what they expect month after month, then I'm afraid the economic policy of the coalition is toast. And the other, of course, important thing that's come out in the last week is that the economy shrank by more than expected in the last quarter, by 0.4% rather than 0.3%, which doesn't sound much. But the economy basically is shrinking, the deficit is growing. I think if this carries on like this, there's going to be a political crisis about it.
Okay, Martin, hang on there for a second. Stephen Williams, tell us what your role is financially in the government at the moment.
What's relevant to this is I chair the Liberal Democrat backbench Committee on Treasury and Business, Economic Affairs, I suppose would be the shorthand way of describing it, and John Redwood does the same for the Conservative side of the coalition, and between us we try and influence our ministers who are in government. So the Deputy Prime Minister and the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Danny Alexander, will be the people I talk to extensively about the budget in the month or so before the budget itself.
But it sounds like you're arm-twisting Danny Alexander, who's then arm-twisting George. It's a few arms away, isn't it? How much influence do you actually have?
Well, I'm not. I don't know how much notice they take of my arm twisting. I've reason to believe they take some notice of it, and I know because of conversations that took place in the run up to the budget, for instance, about the 50p tax rate, that how the budget turned out, as delivered by the Chancellor, is not how it might have turned out a few weeks before. And Martin didn't mention what was the actual main measure in the budget, which was raising the personal tax threshold next year to £9,200, which means that 2 million people will have been lifted out of taxation, income tax, altogether by the government, and 24 million people will have had a tax cut. In terms of the 50p dropping to 45p, you're talking about a relatively small number of people and £100 million, whereas raising the threshold costs the government £3 billion to do. So in terms of where the money's gone, it's people at the lower end of the income scale have been helped by the income tax changes far more than the people at the top end.
But how do you answer this whole business of the massive increase in borrowing right now, and also the fact that you've been in power 18 months nearly 2 years now, and we're still not seeing any kind of pickup? Now that Labour left the situation, the economy looked like it was just starting to pick up, but now it's flatlining, well, if not going down, isn't it? It's a depression, slow depression.
Well, there were certainly some. The economy crashed to an extraordinary extent in 2008-2009. Our economy shrank by about 7%, and we still haven't recovered to where we were before the economy started shrinking at the end of 2007. But there is growth in the system. It's not where we'd like it to be, but the predictions, whether by our own independent Office of Budgetary Responsibility or by other people like the OECD, the IMF, and other external commentators, are all predicting that the British economy will grow in 2012 and have stronger growth in 2013. And that's against a background of our European neighbours doing rather worse. And of course, these are our major trading partners. So this crisis on our doorstep obviously has an effect on our own ability to grow, but you know, our economy is expected to grow. And the deficit, contrary to what Martin said, the deficit is actually going down overall, but obviously month on month, sometimes you borrow more and sometimes you borrow less. And then Martin chose 1 month's figures.
Yeah, well, I did say it was 1 month's figures. I'm not reading too much into it. I feel that the mainstream economists who are predicting that the economy will grow are going to get it wrong. I think their models are wrong. I think it's more likely that we're going to go into a deflationary spiral now, not just Britain. You know, it's not just a British problem.
Why is that? Why, Martin?
Because if everybody is going to start cutting back, where is the demand in the world economy going to come from?
Do you
want
to answer that one, Steve?
We've done these discussions several times over the last few years. Martin always predicts doom on the horizon.
I do, don't I?
And he hasn't been justified so far. So we'll have to wait and see.
But will.
This is the thing about Martin. Martin is an economist. I won't make all the jokes that everyone knows about economists, but there are a range of views. Martin's clearly at the pessimistic end.
I'm a bear.
Many others.
I'm a bear.
The concentration of opinion for the British economy is at the optimistic.
One of the things is pretty clear, Stephen, is things aren't picking up. We've just seen the biggest owner of business parks in the southwest go bust this week. You know, this is you know, it doesn't certainly look as if there's any kind of light at the end of the tunnel right now. So, can you convince us that there is?
Well, I think there is light at the end of the tunnel, and plenty of people are investing in Britain. I don't know who the business parks owner in the southwest is, but you know that happens anyway. Even when an economy is booming and growing, businesses fail, and that's the dynamic of capitalism. That some businesses will always be failing as other people enter the market and grow to fill that space.
Well,
that happens all the time.
They're called London and West Country Estates Limited, and they control 27 sites across Somerset and the southwest down to Bridgewater, Plymouth, and also have 300 commercial tenants still. Of course, many of that's actually quite a large number, because many of their places are now vacant and they're not getting any income from them.
But looking into our own economy in Bristol, I mean, Bristol weathered the recession probably better than any other major city in the country, and we are still the most prosperous English city in England. There are various things the government has put in place that will help the economy in Bristol, just around the corner from where we are. There's going to be a new enterprise zone around Temple Meads for new media businesses to enter into the market in Bristol. I think we're going to see major growth in that area. Construction is starting to pick up, and some government funding is helping with that. For instance, the big site behind MSHED that most people will be familiar with on Wapping Wharf, that's been dormant since the crash in 2008, has now got government money in order to start doing the infrastructure works so that they can start building these new homes, employing construction workers so that people have jobs and spending money in the local economy. So good things are happening, but you know, I'm not going to pretend that it's not going to be a real struggle in order to get Britain back on track.
Now, Kerry, what's your view then on the budget? Because, I mean, if we were to believe Ed Balls, it wouldn't be actually a lot of difference. You're just basically saying that the cuts are too far and too fast. Not that you shouldn't be cutting, that the government should be actively, proactively going out into the economy and spending in order to kickstart the economy.
Yeah, I mean, our view is that you can't make cuts like this at a time when the economic recovery is very shaky and possibly teetering on the back brink of going back into recession. Because if you make public spending cuts, you know, it's very straightforward. You make public spending cuts, put people out of work, reduce the ability of the public sector to spend money on supplies and so on, then that has a knock-on impact on the private sector as well. More people unemployed, fewer people paying taxes, more people claiming benefits, etc., etc. And the government's stance seems to be that you can make the cuts at public sector level, and yet the private sector will suddenly spring into life and create all these jobs. And we just don't believe that will happen. So it's an economic analysis as well as an argument about fairness, because the other thing, as Martin just said, is when you are looking at cuts and spending restraints, the question is who bears the burden of that. And we've just had a budget where the top rate of tax has been cut from 50p. Millionaires will benefit to the tune of some 40,000 or so a year. And, you know, is that a priority when you're then at the other end of the scale? It's said that they need to find another 10 billion in welfare cuts, which we'll see come through later this year when we have the spending review. Is that really the right priority?
So, Stephen, I mean, we're seeing unemployment going up at an incredible rate. This obviously means that less people are paying tax, more money has to go out in benefits. I mean, it sounds to me as if you're propping up a government of the millionaires, by the millionaires, for the millionaires, particularly with this top rate tax cut.
Well, I think that's an unfair caricature of the position. The cut in the top rate of tax was not our priority, but and the timing of that cut and the level of that cut is different, because we are there. The Liberal Democrat priority in the budget was to help the low-paid and part-time workers who can now keep more of their own money if they're on low wages, and sending out the measure that work pays and making it easier for employers to take on people if they're making a marginal decision on whether to take on an extra person. It is now easier to do that. That was our priority. That was the yellow bit of the budget. The blue bit of the budget was that cut in the top rate of tax. But what hasn't been mentioned so far is that there are new taxes coming in on the wealthy people who own assets, in particular property and homes, who are buying homes worth more than £2 million. You know, I am a progressive politician, but I'm interested in effective taxes on the rich, not a particular level of tax that has a sort of symbolic value like the 50p rate. I'm in favour of effective taxes on the rich, and what we're putting in place on stamp duty and avoidance measures is predicted to raise rather more money than has been lost by this cut.
Why haven't you done both? Why not keep the 50p as well?
Well, the 50p rate is being kept for another year, and actually the coalition will have presided for 3 years of the 50p top rate of tax. You know, the Labour government presided for 37 days.
We didn't need it at a time when the economy was doing well, but then when it came to having to share the burden, the economy started to shrink
in 2007.
Yeah, and then we introduced it as a measure to say that the rich ought to be paying their fair share
the
as well
election,
as hitting
yes.
that.
Yeah, it does seem to me, Stephen, I wonder whether, you know, your Liberal Democrat Party up at Westminster is actually managing to squeeze enough out of the Conservatives as part of that coalition in order to actually stand a chance of getting any kind of a good result at the next general election. Because for many people, they see you as kind of almost like doormats for the Conservatives.
I think that's your viewpoint. But a coalition is we haven't had coalition government in this country in peacetime in anyone's living memory. So everyone is having to get used to two parties working together, and neither of us get our way on everything. Sometimes the Conservative viewpoint prevails, sometimes our viewpoint prevails. And if you look at the budget, do you think a Conservative government's priority would have been to spend £3 billion on raising the poorest people in society out of the income tax net altogether? I don't think so.
If you actually look at the distributional impact of that change, though, people at the bottom, the very poorest, because they're not paying income tax anyway, aren't helped that much by it. The people, it's actually about the sort of sixth, seventh, eighth decile that are gaining the most. Yeah, so, but you're presenting it as though this is all about helping the poorest. It's not actually helping the poorest as much as people that are on sort of reasonably good incomes.
And the fact is, it's a measure that helps people who are in work, yes.
What I think the Lib Dems are trying to do is to sort of cherry pick and say these are the good things that we've done, but we're going to ignore all the bad things that we've facilitated. So the fact that they've managed to get this rise in the income tax threshold is somehow seen as fair compensation for cutting the 50p top rate of tax, destroying the NHS, raising tuition fees to £9,000, etc.
NHS being laid ruin in Bristol. Did I miss something? Is the BRI being blown
up?
The ultimate point here is, I mean, Nick Clegg could be holding a gun to David Cameron's head, metaphorically, and saying, look, if you don't do what I say, I'm going to force a general election, chump. And he's not doing that, is he?
Well, coalition is about negotiation in between the two parties who are in the coalition, and those negotiations take place every day over a huge variety of issues. Every single policy that the government comes up with goes through various committees, and ultimately this quad of the Prime Minister, the Deputy Prime Minister, the Chancellor and the Chief Secretary, so it's a 50-50 relationship, make the ultimate decisions over what goes forward.
So you
want to
see the coalition go the full term, do you?
Well, we've entered into a coalition for 5 years, political joint venture, if you like, to help sort out the economy and get our country back on track. And I think we both need to see it
Until 2015. Only time will tell if the country goes back on track, or whether we get the Martin Doom scenario. Anyway, on to our next story. Cas for Access row puts spotlight on party funding. This is from The Guardian, Sunday 25th. This is a Cash for Access row involving Conservative Party co-treasurer Peter Cruddas has thrown spotlight on the debate over political funding, which has been prompted by allegations of donors trying to buy influence. Now, David Cameron denounced lobbying, an industry estimated to be worth £2 billion annually, as the next big scandal waiting to happen in a speech in February 2010. Kerry, are you on this one first? I mean, what does this teach us about the way politics really works at the top level?
I think, there's been a number of stories like this, and the ability of the Conservative Party to raise huge sums of money from wealthy individuals. I mean, they're not the only party that does it, but they are far more successful and have far more wealthy people putting large sums of money in. Is something that I think, inevitably questions need to be asked about. What do people hope to get from these donations? Would you pay, at one level, people who support political parties, I'm particularly thinking of someone like Lord Sainsbury, who's donated to a number of political causes. I think at the moment he's supporting the Vote Yes for Elected Mayors campaign. And that's because he genuinely believes in those causes and doesn't really expect to get anything back. But for every Lord Sainsbury, there's other people that do have a particular agenda and are cosying up to government because they want to be able to get that agenda on the government's radar and hopefully implemented.
But it is fuel to the fire, isn't it? That for many people that feel that it's just money that's running the top level of politics, Stephen. Yeah.
Yes, and I think the three parties have a duty to clean this up. This problem is blown up this week. It's the Tory party that's got egg all over its face at the moment. In the past, my party, the Liberal Democrats, have had embarrassments. Labour Party's had embarrassments. Lord Levy raised vast amounts of money for Tony Blair from rich individuals. Of course, Tony Blair is the only Prime Minister in history who's actually had to do an interview under police caution about cash for access so far. Political donations.
Yeah, but isn't
it's in all of our interest to clean this up.
Isn't, Isn't the problem here, though, that there are skeletons in the closet here of who's been funding who? Yeah. And nobody really wants an investigation into this, because it will expose both politicians and donors as being involved in basically buying influence in political parties.
Yeah. I mean, Kerry gave an example of an individual who has support. In fact, he supported my party in the past and supported the Labour Party more recently. Obviously, giving money to a political party ought to be seen as a good thing in a democracy. But people who give vast amounts of money, it's fairly obvious, really, that they're expecting something in return. Now, it may be social cachet of saying, I've had supper with the Prime Minister, or it may be policy influence. But I think if we all think this smells, I think it smells, then we have to agree a reform package that deals with it. And I'm in favour of a cap on donations from whatever source to any political party. An independent inquiry suggested £10,000.
People can get around that, Stephen, can't they? They'll make sure that a little bit goes this way, a little bit goes that way. You know, that if someone wants to make a donation, they'll split it up into bits and make sure it doesn't go over the cap.
Well, we have good laws in place, and the last Labour government actually did this on declaring donations from whatever source, so that should pick that up. But I think if you had a cap on the amount that an individual can give to a political party, now, it's been suggested £10,000, you know, maybe it could be £20,000, but I don't think it should be much more than that, because these are extraordinary amounts, given that the average wage in this country is somewhere between £23,000 and £26,000.
Kerry, what is going to happen about this? Anything going to happen? Because just before Christmas, we heard David Cameron promising an investigation into lobbying. By the end of January, he decided he didn't want to do it.
I mean, there's talk about, you know, register of lobbyists, but which makes things a little bit more transparent, but that's only actual private sector lobbying firms, and there's an awful lot of other relationships that go on, and relationships with people who don't have lobbyists as intermediaries, but company bosses and so on. So I don't think, you know, it's a little bit of it, but it doesn't go to
what's
the heart
actually
really
make
what's
this,
going on.
What's going to make it happen, though? Make
I,
this
I think,
exposed and transparent?
Yeah, I think actually, you know, a further reduction in the amount that could be spent on elections would be helpful. There's a lot of money that's spent on, you get into a bit of a billboard war where everyone thinks they've got to spend vast amounts of money on billboards, which I suspect have very, very little impact on the election result. So I think there's we need to look at things like that. I do think, you know, the transparency about who ministers are meeting with is very important. The problem is you then get into a Liam Fox situation where he could have put on the record all his formal meetings, but he had this habit of bumping into people in hotel lobbies and having a drink with them, which wouldn't have been caught. And obviously those are the meetings that you really, really need to
and
know
being
about.
And being a shadow director of various companies, as we've heard.
So it's all the things that are happening when the civil servants aren't there that you really need to know about, but they wouldn't be the ones that
have been
caught.
Helping war criminals out in Sri Lanka who are herding around tens of thousands of Tamils and getting them shot by the military. So anyway, let's have a listen now to what you think about party funding, because Marina Morris has been out on the streets to talk to you about the party funding system.
If the rich pay for privileged access and influence, is this true democracy?
I don't think it would be true democracy, no, because, see, it's swaying things in the favour of the people who have more money. It's certainly very risky, because it can just mean that the rich get their own interests put ahead of other people. So
that does not surprise me, because I used to work for Oxford University as a butler, and I used to see the dinner parties they threw for government officials, and they were definitely ridiculously overpriced. You basically give your cousin the job in the government, you know, in sort of certain areas and big businesses and stuff. And so even if you're the most educated, hardworking people, I know many of them who have been studying for years, they're amazing, they're potentially really great lawyers, they can't even get their foot in the door. The poor people generally were too uneducated, and we're so dulled down in the society, keeping ourselves busy with the X Factor and some sort of starlet is up to, that we've kind of been stupefied. We need to feel empowered a bit more. But yeah, for the government, it's very practical, the situation.
Yeah, scandalous. I think the government definitely favour the rich. The recent budget just shows that they're taxing the over 65s and the honest working family. It doesn't pay to go to work, basically.
It's not true democracy. Because true democracy, everybody has an equal shout. Are some people worth more than others? No. Not in terms of having an equal vote. Unfortunately, giving everybody the same vote doesn't necessarily always work out for the best, so I think it's not necessarily something that's easy to answer.
Privileged and influential people are okay. They will be eating food tonight, but other people won't be. Unfortunately, I happen to be unemployed. All these people here, the rich people are just getting richer and the poor people are getting poorer. This man, he's corrupt. He is a criminal.
How should political parties be funded? And should there be a limit on how much political parties spend trying to influence how we vote?
I think it would be fairest if there was a limit, certainly if each party was limited to spending the same amount on influencing people. That would, in terms of how they're funded, there's not really any easy way around that, really, apart from, you know, just seeking support from people who want to back them, really.
Well, if they're going to be supporting the people and really want to make changes for the people of this country, then they should live like them. And I think by the time you're at the top, you're so corrupted anyway, your ego is going to get in the way. And you're always going to have people that agree with you, and the people who agree with you are the people who are giving you money, and then you're helping with their investments. It's just intrinsically, it's never going to work. Either do something about it if you're going to go into politics and really shake it up, or just back away.
I don't think they should spend to excess. They should spend as minimal as possible, really. The amount of money they've got shouldn't really persuade who votes for them. They should just use whatever means they've got without having to spend loads of money, basically.
The Conservative Party get donated an awful lot of money. The Labour Party get donated money. But there's also a party called the English Defence League that, whether you agree with their policies or not, don't get no funding. How can it be democratic if they're not being allowed to express their views on an open platform, but yet Labour, Conservative and the Liberal Democrats can, but the British National Party can't. Not just them, I'm talking about the Green Party. They don't get no funding. They actually lose their deposits.
I suppose it depends on whether it's their money or not. If they're looking for money from the general population, then I suppose it depends. As long as it's equally shared and it doesn't impact on the services that the government provides, then... But it certainly shouldn't influence anything. The money should be separate from all that. Obviously, people who donate are always going to want some form of power over the people they're donating to. But if they're donating for the right reasons and it doesn't provide them with any additional influence than anybody else, then it's fine.
OK, that was you and your views on party funding. But the final story this week we're looking at is the criminalisation of squatting. Squatting was finally passed through the House of Lords as a criminal offence. It's going to mean, apparently, homeless people who shelter in empty homes and turn them into criminals, looking at a year in prison or a £5,000 fine. What do you make of this one, Stephen Williams, Lib Dem MP?
Well, there's a wide spectrum of squatters, aren't there? I mean, nobody, I think, would want to throw the full force of the law at someone who is homeless, who crawls into a property that's been empty for many years to get a night's shelter. That's one end of the spectrum. I wouldn't want people like that to
be
locked up.
But those are people will be caught in this new law.
Well, you have common sense in who you bring charges against and whether the CPS takes a view to court. You know, those factors are weighed up. But at the other end of the spectrum, you have people who deliberately occupy property that is not at all derelict, is perhaps in between sales going from one owner to another. They're not genuinely homeless at all, because if they were, you know, the council would house them, or a charity would house them in a hostel, and basically they're after a good time at somebody else's expense. We've got a big example of that in a house in Clifton at the moment, which is causing misery for hundreds of residents.
So are you behind this or not, before Kerry gets her chance?
Well, so I'm behind it, but I certainly think the law needs to be changed, because
it's already possible for someone in civil law, it could take 2 weeks, but what if your house has been empty for 10 years?
Well, yeah, that's an extreme example, though, isn't it? A house has been empty for 10 years. If someone who is homeless goes into a property that has been empty and the landlord is negligent, hasn't been repairing it, doesn't care about it, that's one circumstance. But where the property does belong to someone who is perhaps selling it, or it's their own investment, property might be the only thing they have, and people deliberately occupy that property, use the electricity,
as I've said,
no intention of moving on.
You can already get an eviction order through civil. What about you, Kerry? What's your thoughts on this one?
I'd rather see the focus on action at the empty homes end of the scale. I mean, things like giving local authorities the power and the resources to do compulsory purchase orders and to tighten up. I was meeting the council tax people at the council earlier today, and they were saying they're going to be stricter about imposing council tax on the people who own empty homes and things like that, so that it's actually not that, you know, that people have a financial incentive to put the properties back into use. I think that's how we're going to deal with the homeless problem, not by focus in on the sort of small number of squatters that are likely to be prosecuted.
One of the reports is saying that this could cost £790 million over 5 years to actually deal with squatters, but this being costs of policing. Maybe what they're saying essentially is that the official estimate has been plucked out of the air, and it will wipe out the government legal aid budget savings, according to the findings of a newly published report for Squatters Action for Secure Homes. That's squash. Okay, so Kerry, are you behind this or not, ultimately?
I think the civil laws would have been, perhaps with an accelerated process would have been sufficient.
That's all we've got time for. Thank you, Kerry McCarthy, Labour MP, and Stephen Williams, Lib Dem. We'll be back after the news.
Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the